Blog Talk Radio.
My calculations are correct. When this baby hits 88 miles per hour, you're gonna see some serious sh-
What's up, everybody? Welcome to Punch Drunk Critics Live on Sunday night at 7 o'clock, or if you're listening to us in podcast form, whatever day and time it is now for you. We have a huge week this week, but not so much in terms of new releases. We do have a couple new releases to talk about, but the WAFCA Awards, or Washington Area Film Critics Association Awards, can you tell why we use the term WAFCA, is going to be announced tomorrow morning, our nation's capital's precursor to the Oscars. If history has anything to tell us, we're usually pretty close with what the Oscar winners are. So those will be announced tomorrow morning. Our own Travis Hobson and our good buddy Tim Gord will be announcing those winners tomorrow morning. So we're going to be breaking down all the nominees, talking about who's most likely to win, all that kind of good stuff. And, you know, I know I have a couple of things to talk about who didn't get a nomination, who I think should have, you know, all that kind of stuff we'll be going over. As I said, Tim Gordon will be announcing it tomorrow morning with Travis. But Tim's also going to join us tonight to talk a little bit about the awards. Pretty big stuff happening around here. It's been a crazy, crazy week for us. I know me especially, because I was procrastinating on a couple of different screeners that I have to watch this time of year. The studios sent us copies of movies to watch at home so we can, because we couldn't possibly see all of these movies if we had to go to the theater and schedule it and all that. So we usually get about 40 to 50 movies to watch, and that's kind of a conservative estimate. Between, let's say, mid-October and right now, the first week of December. So I put off a lot of my more marquee type movies, the bigger names that came out, to watch this week, just so they'd be fresh in my mind when it came to voting. And I gotta tell you, man, it's woo, I feel like a pregnant woman. I'm so emotional right now with all these movies I've been watching this last week.
Really?
Yeah, just a, you know, because I was telling everybody I saved a lot of the bigger name screeners that I got for this past week so I could be fresh in my mind for voting and everything. And, you know, Les Mis, Miserables, or however you say it, you know, Beasts of Southern Wild I watched again, Cloud Atlas, which, you know, not so much emotional, but The Master, all these different movies, and it's just like emotions everywhere, just like it's been pulled out of me. So that craziness is over for us finally, as our votes are in and our awards will be announced tomorrow morning. And you guys are announcing those on Film Gordon, right?
Yes, we'll be announcing the winners tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. on our good friend Tim Gordon show, Keeping It Real with Film Gordon, and he'll be on here at about 7:30 to go through the nominees with us and kind of talk about our own picks and things like that a little bit, some surprises in the nominations, things like that. So, it'll be me and him tomorrow, so that should be fun as always. And you know, this time of year is always, it's kind of like the final thing we have to do to kind of cap off the year.
Right.
Is our big WAFCA Awards thing. And you know, the December month is so stressful.
Yeah.
There's so much going on. There's so many movies to watch. And you know, in my case, I see about 200 movies a year. I know you see a lot as well. And there are still so many that we don't get to see, that we're still cramming like we're in college or something in those last few days before we do our voting. So it's you know, it's kind of good to have everything just kind of done and over with, and then we can move on and get ready for 2013. It's time to start looking forward.
Yeah. I mean, I can honestly say that this year, you know, it was a huge lead up to it, and I managed to watch more of the movies I was sent this year than I have any other year by a good margin. Usually, I just watch the major things and maybe five or six of the smaller name movies that I think will be worth watching. But I tried to watch. I probably watched 85 to 90% of what I was sent, and it's just like I'm so much more vested in it now. And you enter your nominations and you get the actual legit nominees back that everybody voted on. And you got some heartbreaks and then you got some obvious things. But it's definitely cool to have it out there. Now it's done. The weight is off our chest. And we just have to wait till tomorrow morning to see what everything wins. So you guys can check that out right here on Blog Talk Radio, blogtalkradio.com/filmgordon. Travis and Sam will be announcing those at 8 a.m. So make sure to tune in for that.
Yeah, yeah. But as for this week in movies, I don't know if you talked about what we're doing this week besides that.
I mentioned there were two, but I didn't say
okay.
anything about them.
Okay, yeah. Well, this is kind of a slow week. And we've had a couple of these. This happens after Thanksgiving. You get a couple of slow weeks, and then you get pounded with the stuff that's trying to come in at the end of the year, the big stuff. But this is one of the slow weeks, and we have two movies. The bigger of the two, I guess if you can call it that, is Playing for Keeps, which is a romantic comedy with Gerard Butler, who at this point when I see his name, it pretty much just means there's incoming crap on the way.
Right.
I mean, it's pretty much that's just what his name signifies now. And there was a time that I really actually liked him a lot, and those days are long gone. The other film is Deadfall, which, as you know, is a film I was really looking forward to.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to see it at the Virginia Film Festival and went to see something else. Went to see House Hunting, actually, that day.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't see Deadfall. I don't know if I would have won regardless of what I did, but we're going to be talking about that. It's a thriller which has a fantastic cast. Eric Bana, who I love, Olivia Wilde, who I also kind of love, Charlie Hunnam, who I enjoy quite a bit, Sissy Spacek, Kris Kristofferson, and Kate Mara. I love Kate Mara.
Mm-hmm.
So this movie has a fantastic cast in it. Whether or not it's any good or not, we'll talk about that in a minute. But
you want to just knock Playing for Keeps out of the way? I don't think either one of us really has too much to say about this one.
I don't know how much we have to say about either one of them. But let's start with Playing for Keeps, because it is the big movie of the week. So let's just go ahead and start with that.
That works. You got Gerard Butler playing George. I'm not sure if that name was chosen because it's close to Gerard, so he wouldn't forget in this obvious paycheck movie. But George is a down and out former soccer star who's coaching his son's soccer team, and that kind of serves as the center point of everything. And from here on out, it's pretty much standard insert job, insert what the kid does, insert job making you go somewhere else type deal, where he has to make decisions between, you know, what he's going to do with his life, and then he has romances that come in and out, and what's important in his son's life and what's important in life, as it were.
Yeah.
But to, for the cast that this movie had, I shouldn't really say that, but there's Jessica Biel, Gerard Butler, Dennis Quaid, Uma Thurman, Catherine Zeta-Jones, who's making some kind of – well, not starting with this, hopefully, but making some kind of comeback in Hollywood, even down to the smaller names like Judy Greer. I mean, you have a lot of good people in this movie that
– great cast.
To buy extra Christmas presents or something, because this is literally I don't have much to say about it, because it's literally – less than just a formulaic romantic comedy. I mean, I'm sure that there are some people that will go see it on a Friday night as a date movie, and it'll be just fine for them. They won't be mad that they went. It'll serve as the 2 hours between getting dinner and deciding if you're going to go back to his house or not.
You know what? That comment you just made sounds like something the writers of this movie would have said. Like, they probably said it in the writing room while they're at their keyboard. He would have made a joke like that, because this is one of the most demeaning movies to women I've seen in a minute. Now, I complain about this a lot when it comes to romantic comedy, especially ones that have primarily female casts. But this is the worst kind. This is the kind that has the guy at the center and the women all around him are poorly characterized, to say the least.
Mm-hmm.
This movie was originally titled Playing the Field. And I suspect that the reason why they changed the name to Playing for Keeps has nothing to do with soccer. It has to do with the fact that it sounds awfully crass when you have this one character, the George character played by Gerard Butler. Essentially, the whole movie is about the women throwing themselves at him and him getting laid by every soccer mom in town.
Yeah.
And that's really all this movie is. I mean, there's really not that much more to it, except for this little itty-bitty bit of family drama they tried to throw in there with him trying to get back with his ex-wife, played by Jessica Biel. Presumably, she is the most down to earth of them all. But in the context of this film, it means she's really fucking boring.
Yeah.
Like, she has no personality at all in this movie. Whereas at least Catherine Zeta-Jones looks nice, and she's kind of, I mean, she's a bit of a skank biscuit, I guess.
She's good at playing that role, though. Nothing to her personally, but she has that look, like a little femme fatale to her.
She is good at playing that role. And then you have Judy Greer, who's a fantastic comedian. And she gets the unfortunate role of this kind of stalker-ish bipolar chick who's like coming off a bad relationship or something, and she's just throwing herself at Gerard Butler. And then there's Uma Thurman, who also is very good at comedy when she gets the opportunity. And her highlight is dressing up in lingerie and sneaking into his bed. I mean, this is really, for female actresses, this is really thin stuff here. I mean, it's just, this is the epitome of a paycheck movie. And that extends to Dennis Quaid. I mean, it's not just about the women here. Dennis Quaid is phoning it in also. The only one who doesn't seem to be phoning it in is Gerard Butler. And that's sad, because this is probably the best he can do. I mean, we've seen him do movies like Machine Gun Preacher and Coriolanus, where he tried to do a little bit more than this kind of thing. But, you know, nobody saw those movies anyway, so they don't really count.
Yeah, but I mean, I know a lot of people liked the revenge movie that I had in front of me. Now I forget what it's called. Law Abiding Citizen. A lot of people liked that a lot. I liked it a lot. But in between everything else he has, it's pretty much like he can do one thing very well, and that's be an angry masculine dude. But I get that the ladies love him in the romantic. I mean, I know a lot of women that loved him in P.S. I Love You. It's got less to do with his acting and more to do with his dreamy accent that he puts on.
He's got a mop of hair and a Scottish accent that makes him seem charming. And I'm sure it works to some extent, but I think those days have long passed where they stopped working. I mean, I think The Ugly Truth actually made some money back when it came out. But I think those days where he was – where people looked at him that way as a viable leading man, as this guy that people want to come see in theaters, I think those days are over for him. I think those days have gone. He's gotten a little bit older. He's kind of got stuck playing these same roles for a long time. Hugh Grant fell into this pattern for a while. Hugh Grant is so charming that it never really hurt him. Like, he played this role like 5 straight times.
Yeah.
And then he got out of it for a little while. He kind of took a break. Like, he hasn't done one of these in a few years, you know, and now it's like, and now he'll probably start doing them again, actually, looking at what he's got coming up. But Gerard Butler just keeps making them and keeps making them, and he always comes off as the guy who seems most desperate to be in the movie. Like, he's always the one who, it seems like somebody, like the producers approached somebody bigger than him, and then they're like, fuck it, we got Gerard Butler.
Yeah, we'll take it. And his agent was like, well, yeah, Leo turned it down. Leo, I mean, where Leo is? Awesome. And he gets in there and takes his shirt off, calls it a day. I mean, I really wish you hadn't said, look what Hugh Grant's doing soon, because now I see that Bridget Jones's Baby is coming out in pre-production. Yeah. They're still going for that,
and he's got another romantic comedy coming up, too. I can't remember what it was that I was writing about.
Which was, we will refer to the star of Bridget Jones's Baby, Renee Zellweger, in our next review for Deadfall. But
We will.
You'll see how I do it. I mean, playing for keeps. I usually have a lot of a space to give for just run of the mill romantic comedies, but I think this was a little bit less than that. This almost seemed like if you would have made a couple of jokes in different places, it could have been one of those spoof movies with some different actresses in there. But it's a 1.5 out of 5 for me. I'm sure some people it'll service just fine as a Friday date movie if you don't, just want to see something you don't have to think about. But I can't really recommend anybody go to see this.
Most interesting, especially for us here in the D.C., Maryland, Virginia area, this movie takes place in Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
It's shot in Louisiana.
Which looks nothing like Virginia, by the way, everybody.
It looks like it was shot in Louisiana.
Yeah.
I commented to somebody, and I was like, does any of this – I think it might have been Kevin McCarthy, actually. I was like, does any of this look like Virginia or D.C. or anything to you? I was like, where is this shot? And I had to go look it up myself, and I was like, oh, Louisiana, okay. And, and I know they did it for the tax breaks and all that crap, because Louisiana is really good for that right now. But, I mean, seriously. it just
yeah. –
It was just it was really distracting for me. It was distracting, like when I watched the comebacks or the replacements. The replacements.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
And
oh.
it was supposed to be DC, and I was like, it doesn't look like DC.
Yeah.
that looks like Baltimore.
I suppose everywhere gets that a little bit, but I think we get it the worst because most movies that say they're shooting in New York or L.A. or Miami shoot in those places because it's normal to shoot there. But D.C., we're kind of in a weird place where we're not a huge movie shooting area where there's not a lot of tax breaks. There's not a lot of incentives for people to shoot in Maryland, Virginia, or D.C. Mm. But we're important enough where movies take place here. So, like, if you look at The Last Die Hard, you've got these huge overpasses that don't exist in D.C. You got skyscrapers, and it's one of those things that just gets under your skin. But
it's really bad for D.C. D.C. is such a distinct place. I mean, you can't when it's really off, it looks really bad when you're trying to do D.C. It's like, come on,
yeah,
just come on, just put a little effort into it to make it at least seem authentic. It just really didn't. I found that really distracting. So. This was a 1.5 out of 5 for me. Also, I don't understand how anybody could take a shine to this movie, and that goes for people who are romantic comedy fans. I think even for them, this one is almost too formulaic, even for them. It's too, their characters are too razor thin, even for them. I'm just not sure what there is to like about this movie. So, and I actually just glanced. I usually don't do this, but I actually just glanced at Rotten Tomatoes to see what it had to score, and it's at 2%. And
which,
2%
you know,
on a Sunday, which means this movie's been out for 3 days now. Mm-hmm. 2% that deep into its run is really bad.
you know what got me on Rotten Tomatoes? Because, I mean, I the tomato meter I get, you know, I pay attention to it. But I always like the audience meter because, you know, your view is really different if you see a whole lot of movies or if you go once every 6 months.
Oh, yeah.
So I always look at the audience meter for movies like this and action movies, and the audience meter is only at 54%. So that means half the people that went in, and with romantic comedies, people are usually very, very generous with their scores. Like, oh, you know, it was good. I'll give it an 80%, you know, but, you know, at 54%. That means half the people that like these movies that went to see it right now where all these other movies are out didn't like it. So there you go.
Yeah, pretty ugly. All right, let's talk about Deadfall.
Shall we?
Let's talk about Deadfall. I'm not even sure how to really approach this film. It's a thriller that comes your way from Stefan Rozowitzki, who in 2007 directed The Counterfeiters, which won Best Foreign Language Award at the Oscars. And my sound just started messing up. Okay, there we go. That sounds better. The story begins in the dead of a really bad snowstorm, and where three criminals are fleeing a casino heist. And in the midst of the storm, they have a really bad crash. Only two of them survive. Addison, played by Eric Bana, and his sister Liza, played by Olivia Wilde. And they have this really kind of creepy, sort of incestuous sort of relationship thing going on that I couldn't quite put my finger on.
Yeah.
Anyway, they decide to split up because they actually murder a cop who comes to investigate the scene, and deciding to split up and find shelter. He goes his own way and goes off on his own little trek, while she goes off in another direction and runs into Jay, who is an ex-con played by Charlie Hunnam. Jay has just gotten out of prison for a crime, and literally within hours, he's already maybe killed somebody. So he's on the run also. He meets up with Liza, and they get off on this sort of weird romantic entanglement while he's off to his Thanksgiving home, or to his home for Thanksgiving with his parents, played by Sissy Spacek and Chris Christopherson. So immediately what happens in this movie is you've got two separate storylines going on. You've got Addison off on his journey, which has him running into random people and either killing them or dispensing really strange advice to them. And then you've got this other storyline going on with Addison and Liza, and they're developing a relationship. But in the midst of that, you've also got storylines going on between Jay's parents. You've got another plot going on with a cop named Hannah, played by Kate Mara, who's having problems with her father, who is the local town sheriff. So you've already got four or five different storylines going on here at once. My problem with it is that none of them really make a whole lot of sense. And for a thriller, I never really felt all that thrilled. I'm not really sure what the hell Eric Bana's character is supposed to be doing in this movie. And nor am I really concerned with that relationship between Jay and Liza. I mean, it seems like it was taken from another movie. It just doesn't seem like it fits here. But overall, this movie was a total mess to me.
I can see that. I actually enjoyed this movie quite a bit, more than I thought it was, especially. Because I sat down and watched it. I mean, I got other stuff I could be watching, but I sat down and watched it anyway. And I really started getting into it. There is a lot of crap going on, a lot of it really doesn't need to be going on. Like the entire storyline with Kate Mara and her dad, it basically serves just to show that her dad's a dick. And he doesn't want her involved in any police activity, not because she's a girl, but just because he's a dick, and because he basically wanted a son, so he's not worried about her. That's not why he doesn't let her out. The whole thing could have been shelved, and they could have figured out another way to do that. And the creepy factor really just bugged me because it didn't make any sense that Liza, who's obviously incestuously in love with her brother. And God knows
something,
what they need to do.
Something.
Yeah,
something's going on there.
Well, she tells, and when her and Jay first meet, they say they're going to have like a fantasy type thing. They give each other names, and she calls him Addison, which is her brother, and ends up banging him.
Right.
So that was a clue for me. But you know, when it gets towards the end there, I thought that the climax at the dinner table at Thanksgiving, I thought that was thrilling. If you're going to call it a thriller, you know, I thought that was some suspense going on there. You kind of knew. I honestly didn't know what was going to happen. I figured. Not everybody was going to end up in a pool of blood, but I didn't know exactly who was going to make it and all this kind of stuff. And Eric Bana, I thought was really, really good for what he was given. Like his ability to go from – to just display a perfect sociopath, just being totally sweet to a kid and a baby while
killing
somebody
else. That's why it didn't make any sense to me.
Well, I thought it was – he played it well to the point where you could tell he was nuts off his rocker. But now onto the Renee Zellweger thing. Chris Hunnam – or Charlie Hunnam, excuse me. I think he's good. I think he could be really good, but his acting coach or his agent, somebody's got to tell him that he doesn't need to make a Renee Zellweger lemon face every time he's trying to show emotion. Like somebody says something to him, he just takes on this thing like he's channeling myself and Irene, and he just ate a huge lemon, and it doesn't work. It just looks silly. When he's not doing that and he's talking, I could see him as an action star almost. You know, he's serviceable actor, but...
He's actually a really good actor. I like him a lot. I just there's no emotion to this movie, and I didn't think Eric Bana really did anything of note until the very end, when the movie seems to finally settle on an appropriate tone. One of these things that I think I hate about this movie the most is that it's so deadly goddamn serious. It really shouldn't be. Mm-hmm. This movie is kind of silly. Like if you look at the plot and all these things that are going on, it's really sort of silly.
Yeah,
And yet it doesn't really tap into that until the final moments when there's this great flurry of violence and it gets a little manic. And that's when I like it. I was like, okay, now it's finally settled into a groove. Too bad there's only 5 minutes left in the movie. But I mean, that's my biggest problem with it. And I feel like all these people just seem to be phoning it in really badly. Nobody seems to be all that invested in this movie. And that especially goes to Olivia Wilde, who I think has, at this point, crossed that threshold from popular to overexposed. She's been in so many movies. She did 6 this year alone. I think she did about 5 the year before. She's just been in so many movies, and they've been almost all of them consistently terrible. She makes some really awful choices. Like, she's just... I don't know what it is. When it comes to certain actresses, you see them do this in a lot of movies. They tend to elevate those movies, or these movies will elevate their careers. That doesn't seem to be happening with her. She seems to be staying like in the same spot. She's been in the same place for 3 years now, and it's because all of her movies are really bad. And at some point, you start to be like, maybe she's a big part of the reason why they're so bad. She's really great to look at, but I can't remember. There hasn't been that one performance of hers where I'm like, that was an Olivia Wilde performance. Like, she was really good right there. That's what I'm going to remember about her when I think about her 2 years from now. Like, that performance. There hasn't been that.
No, she has nothing that. I mean, I like her. I do think she's way overexposed. I think she's overrated as far as, because let's face it, she's not liked for her acting talent. She's liked for her beauty. And I don't think in this movie she actually. was strikingly beautiful, especially in the beginning when they were out in the snow and she had this bright red lipstick and this very dark eyeliner and her like porcelain skin. It was like this weird contrast that was gorgeous. But if you look at her filmography, I mean, she's basically scenery in most of these movies. I mean, the last thing I can remember that she had something major to do that wasn't just like a side character was Bickford Schmeckler's Cool Ideas back in 2006, a movie which I really like. But, you know, you go back to all the big ones you had, you know, the Change Up, Cowboys and Aliens, Tron Legacy, and she's never really anything major in any of those. She never does anything that nobody else could do, just a stock actor off the side of the street.
Yeah, it's a shame. I do think she has some level of talent if she ever gets that opportunity, but it doesn't seem like it's going to happen for her. I think she seems content right now to just be window dressing, to just be, the hot chick in a growing ensemble. It just seems to be all she is right now. I loved her in Tron Legacy. I mean, she didn't have a whole lot to do there, but look hot there either. I'd like to see her try something a little bit more. And this movie's not it, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, she's had some good stuff on TV. She did a good stretch on
She was great on House.
The Black Donnellys and the OC, but we're going back.
I'm glad 10 you liked those two episodes of the Black Donnellys.
There's 14 episodes actually. I saw it. I'm looking at it now. That's why I know. But
did they all air?
I don't know if they aired on network TV, but I did see them on Netflix.
I don't think they all aired.
potato. But the last thing I'll say about Deadfall is, speaking of superfluous storylines, the whole thing with Charlie, he gets out of jail, and there's no reason to make him is he bad or is he good type of guy. And the whole opening scene with him where he basically almost thinks he kills the guy that was the reason he went to jail. I mean, the whole reason for that is just to have a cop show up at the end of the movie.
It was awful.
They never showed him worried about it. They never showed him thinking about it. Like every once in a while, they show a little tiny thing where he's like, "Oh yeah, I might be wanted for murder right now. I don't know." But
it's totally forgotten. A lot of these things that happened in this movie are totally forgotten because they're not important. I mean, there's just so much stuff going on in this movie. There's so many different, like I said, so many different threads going on in this movie that almost none of them get any real attention. Like some of them are just thrown out there, and you're like, "Okay, you know, there's that out there now, and I guess we're supposed to remember it, but why?" Why should we? I'm not really given any reason to. Like you said, the one with him possibly killing a man doesn't even come up until much later. Really, I mean, it's just not dealt with, and it doesn't really have any impact. It doesn't inform the character in any way. I was just like, all right, well, whatever. Not all that important.
I think the writers knew that, but then they were too lazy to figure out another way to get the cops to the house at the end of the movie, because the whole way they resolve that is like on the radio. He's like, it's just a concussion, okay. And then you're like, nothing else is said about it later, ever.
that actually made it a lot worse that it was just that they just kind of offhandedly say, oh yeah, he's not really dead. It's just like, and that's a spoiler for anybody who might not have seen Deadfall yet. But I know. But you know what? I have a feeling that there aren't going to be too many of you seeking this movie out anyway, so I'm not going to worry about it. That pissed me off too.
It was good enough for me to get a 3 out of 5. It's definitely a rental, and when it comes out on DVD, I wouldn't bother going to whatever small theater it's playing at and seeing it. But if you got nothing else that weekend, it's not going to kill you to watch it. It was decent enough. 3 out of 5.
I gave it a 2 out of 5, and I only gave it that because I really dug like the atmosphere of it, the snow, the raging snowstorm that's going on throughout the movie. They could have done something really good with that. I mean, I the reason why you have this raging snowstorm going on is because you supposedly have, this great storm, this great cataclysm of events surrounding all these people, but none of that actually happens.
That's
disappointing too.
That was a plot device that could have been used a lot better because I think one of the best things about suspense and horror is taking something that you usually feel comfortable with and making it uncomfortable. And I think that's one place that really hasn't been, tunneled out a whole lot is the fact that even your house where you have your car and you think everything is accessible and you can go anywhere you want. You get the wrong mix of conditions, and even a suburban house is completely isolated. I mean, look at the storm we had 2 years ago where there was 3 feet of snow on the ground and nobody moved for a week. I mean, just exploiting that sense of isolation in a non-isolated area would have been a lot – made this movie a lot better, but they didn't. So.
Yep. All right, 2.5 out of 5 for me, 3 out of 5 for you. So those are our reviews for the week. It is about 7:30 now. Tim Gordon should be calling in just a few minutes. The Giants are blowing out the Saints, so he should be willing to pull himself away from the game and call us in a minute. But until he gets here, let's go ahead and jump into DVDs and the box office really fast.
Okay.
And do that. And then by the time we're done, I'm sure he'll be here.
All right.
But there was really only one major release this week, and that was Playing for Keeps. So this is all a bunch of retreads, which is why you've got Skyfall jumping back into number one with a piddling $11 million, taking it to the top spot. It's at $261 million now. It's over $900 million total. Rise of the Guardians is number two. Actually holding on really well, 21% drop, but it's still going to have a little bit of a ways to go to make up the $150 million price tag.
It's sad. It's an awesome movie.
It is. It really is. Number three is The Twilight Saga Breaking Dawn. Number four is Lincoln, which still is at 2,000 theaters and inching its way up towards $100 million. It'll probably have $100 million by tomorrow. Number five is Life of Pi. Number six is Playing for Keeps, which debuted at $6 million. So those who did bother to see this piece of crap, you know, they hated it, probably. Number seven is Wreck-It Ralph, which just got a sequel greenlit. Mm-hmm. Number eight is Red Dawn. Number nine is Flight. And rounding out the top ten, sadly, is Killing Them Softly, with only $11.8 million after 2 weeks. Sad. Yeah.
If you go just outside the top ten, you know, you really get killed because you see, like, Silver Linings Playbook is not anywhere near its budget. And more people want to see Playing for Keeps than Silver Linings Playbook this week. Now, I'm sure that's because it's in, like, 14 times the theaters, but still, that's such. We'll talk about that a lot later, I'm sure. And then, of course, Rise of the Guardians not being as close as even Wreck-It Ralph. Wreck-It Ralph was good. It's just Rise of the Guardians was great. And sad to see that, but Blu-rays not really too much going on this week. I mean, there's some big ones. Ted, what was the dude's name? I forget, but the guy that does Family Guy,
Seth MacFarlane, Mark Wahlberg, second funniest movie of the year, right behind 21 Jump Street, or maybe that's actually kind of neck and neck for me now because I've seen them both more than once now, and I think Ted might be neck and neck with 21 Jump Street as the funniest movie of the year.
I'll have to see it again to really get into it. Seth MacFarlane, I've been buying into his brand of whimsy for like probably 12 years now since Family Guy first came on, and I'm starting to tire of it because it's not really changing too much. But at the same time, there is a lot of funny stuff in there, a lot of stuff that'll offend equally all across the board.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna check that one out again.
Yeah, and since I see Tim on the board right now, let me just go ahead and sweep through these DVDs really fast if you don't mind. The Bourne Legacy comes out on Tuesday. This is the fourth film in the franchise with Jeremy Renner taking over. I enjoyed it. Didn't love it, but I enjoyed it. Ice Age Continental Drift. Following gets a Criterion release. That's Christopher Nolan's first film. Dick Tracy hits Blu-ray. I might get that just because I liked Dick Tracy a lot when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Backwards, this is the Olympic rowing film with Sarah Megan Thomas and James Van Der Beek. Only mention it because we interviewed Sarah Megan Thomas a couple months ago. She's really sweet. And this one I'm mentioning just because I think it's funny.
Is it the same one I'm thinking of, I think?
Age of the Hobbits.
Yes.
Age of the Hobbits. Me and you and I joke about, you know, these copycat movies that come out right before major films. Age of the Hobbits, starring Christopher Judge and Bai Ling. And I really just want to read the plot synopsis really fast. In an ancient age, the small, peace-loving hobbits are enslaved by the Java men, a race of flesh-eating dragon riders. The young hobbit, Gobin, must join forces with their neighbor giants, the humans, to free his people and vanquish their enemies.
At
How can they not get sued for this?
Wasn't Gilbo or something like that? I don't know. I mean, a hobbit is that's like saying droid or something like that.
Exactly. Isn't that a token thing? Don't you have to get clearance to use hobbits anywhere? I would think you would.
I would think so. And you know what? That oust the one I was going to tell you about this week, and Tim will be with you in just 1 second. I just want to say this one bit. That oust what I had previously as the worst ripoff ever, and that was, I don't know if we talked about it, but on Netflix, there's a movie called Tappy Toes right now, which is a shameless ripoff of Happy Feet, so much so that the story even says this lower budget, lower brow version of Happy Feet. And it's called Tappy Toes. So there you go.
Oh, man. Hey, cue up Tim's music, could you? Let's get him on here.
No problem. Tim, go on.
Yeah. Tim, make the noise. Tim, make the noise. Yeah. Here we go now. Here we go now. Here we go now.
There we go. Tim.
Man, I'm at a sports bar arguing with dumb football fans. listening to you guys. What's going on?
What's up, man? We figured you'd be somewhere watching the Giants kick the Saints' ass this week.
Well, no, I was arguing with somebody who, once you tried to tell me that, you know, that the NFL records that happened before the Super Bowl don't count, which I told you, the dumbest individual I've ever met. Really? Yeah, like before ESPN came along, nothing counts.
But you didn't
get me to talk about that. So what's going on, fellas? How y'all doing?
Not a whole lot. I'm doing pretty good. I was telling Travis earlier that I'm a little bit emotional right now because I've flooded in so many of these big-name movies in the last week and a half for awards voting. My emotions are worn out from all the investment I've done. But other than that, we're good. How are you doing, man?
Man, well, I'm fine, man. I'm glad you guys have an opportunity to talk about our nominees, man. And the first thing I did when I got the nominees yesterday was sit down and start counting the two films that I think are going to be the major players this award season: Zero Dark Thirty, nine WAFTA nominations. What's the other one? Lincoln with six. I'm sorry.
Nine for Lincoln
and six for Zero Dark Thirty. My apologies.
Yeah, I was about to say, I know I didn't have that backwards because I had them all.
Yeah,
right,
man.
And Les Miserables with eight. Les Miserables, right behind Lincoln with eight nominations. So a lot of the major films. Hey, The Master got seven. Argo got five. So a lot of the major films that have already been well received over the last few weeks, playing a big factor here in the WAFTA Awards as well.
Mm-hmm. Now the other news that I was really thrilled to see, Jessica Chastain, who I've talked privately with Travis, and I don't know if I've ever said this to John, to watch her arc from a film she did back in 2008 that I rave about called Jolene,
yeah,
to watching her right now is, and in order to understand what I'm saying, you would have had to have seen Jolene to see just how different and how talented this woman wound up becoming within a four-year time period. It's amazing, man. I mean, she knocks it out the box in Zero Dark Thirty, but it's a very competitive category with several other ladies who are really, really good in it.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. And she goes from The Debt was really her jump off, pretty much, was just 2 years ago. Once she hit The Debt, then you saw her in pretty much at least one major movie every season, whether it be summer, Oscar season, whatever. And I mean, she's going from The Debt to Queer Alliance, which a lot of people didn't see. We got some cred. Tree of Life, The Help, Texas Killing Fields, Madagascar 3, Lawless, Zero Dark Thirty. I mean, she's on a roll is, I think, understating it a little bit.
I think she really took advantage of the Tree of Life. The Tree of Life put her in the position of looking like the saintly angel, and it put her in the place of looking like the leading lady opposite somebody like Brad Pitt and in a challenging Terrence Malick film, and she's used that to her best advantage. But she's got really tough competition in our WAFTA Awards this year. She's facing off with... Anybody else hear that, or is that just me?
No, my apologies, man. This is called The Streets of Washington, D.C.
Okay. It sounded like you had stepped into the middle of a snowstorm. It sounded like you were in the middle of Deadfall, actually. That's what it sounded like you were in.
No, we're saying is she's facing off against you with Jennifer Lawrence.
Jennifer Lawrence for Silver Linings Playbook, Marion Cotillard for Rust and Bone, Helen Mirren for Hitchcock, and Emmanuel Riva for Amour. Tough category. I think out of those five, four of them have a fantastic shot of winning. The only one I would count out is probably Emmanuel Riva, just because I'm not so sure everybody watched Amour because they didn't want to, jump off a building, when they were done. So, but everybody else in that category, I think, has a pretty good shot of winning.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah, I would. Oh, go ahead, John.
I was just going to say, you know, I think her toughest competition is going to come in the form of Marion Cotillard for Rust and Bone. You know, Jennifer Lawrence and Helen Mirren did great jobs, but it wasn't anything exemplary, I thought. I was just kind of disappointed not to see Judi Dench in the nominations for Best Exotic Marigold Hotel. I thought she was wonderful in that.
Well, I was disappointed to not see Quvenzhané Wallace from Beasts of the Southern Wild.
But you knew that was going to happen because we had the youth performance category that's new this year, so people felt justified leaving her off the best actress category. You know what I mean? Go ahead.
No, I was going to say the fact of the matter is I understand that you're absolutely right in your thinking, but the Academy Awards doesn't have a youth performer category. So in order for you to maximize the exposure you need, getting nominations in these Critics Awards are very, very crucial. And, I mean, no disrespect, I agree with you I agree with you wholeheartedly that, you know, the woman, I think her name, I forget what it is, from Amour, I don't really think, me personally, I wasn't a big fan of this film. I know it's been getting raves from coast to coast. It won another Critics Award out in L.A. today as Best Picture. I'm not a fan. So right. I'm not the one to really defend her performance. But I still think that there should be a place for this talented young lady because everybody was captivated by Beasts of the Southern Wild for several months earlier this year. So we remembered Moonrise Kingdom. We remembered several other films that were early this year. We've got to keep that performance in mind as well.
Look, yeah. I'll be the first to admit, I'm not a big fan of the youth performance category in our awards. I don't like it because I don't generally like kid performances. I mean, I just don't think we need to have that separation. But and to be fair, I wouldn't have put Quvenzhané Wallace in my best actress category either. So, you know, it's just one of those things.
I mean, I'm with you, Tim. I mean, she to say she carried that movie is an understatement. I mean, Dwight Henry was amazing as well. I am sad to see him not in another one of our categories. But
right,
you know, Quvenzhané Wallace, she was the focal point, and she doesn't say much, obviously, but she's at such a young age, she's able to convey so much emotion with her eyes and just with her looks that are generally the same throughout, but then she just makes these little changes. I thought she was amazing for her age and what she did.
Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying she was bad. I do think she was great. And I championed her back when the movie came out as well. But if I would have, you know, make my top five actresses, I wouldn't have put her in it.
Right.
I, like you said, I was also disappointed Dwight Henry did not get nominated for Best Supporting Actor for Beasts of the Southern Wild. Now, in that category, that one's also tough. All these categories are tough. They always are. Best Supporting Actor, we've got Alan Arkin for Argo, Javier Bardem for Skyfall for playing the villain, Leonardo DiCaprio for playing a villain in Django Unchained, Philip Seymour Hoffman for kind of playing a villain in The Master, and Tommy Lee Jones for going up against villains in Lincoln. You know, this
so
is...
You said that's a tough one, man.
I do think it's a tough one, actually. I'm not so sure any of these are certain. I know, I don't. I mean, I would personally pick Philip Seymour Hoffman, but I feel like Leonardo DiCaprio is going to take it, and if that's the case, then that's fine. I mean, I think DiCaprio was fantastic in Django Unchained.
Well, let's have a brief conversation about this, the tone of both performances.
Okay.
Philip Seymour Hoffman in The Master, his character is muted charisma. I guess that's probably the best way to say it. There are lots of scenes where Hoffman kind of underplays it because Joaquin Phoenix is the one who's bringing kind of the energy in some of these scenes. But when he has to unleash and do something, he does it quite well. Where on Leo DiCaprio's performance, at least in my estimation, it's all about the show. It's all about the sizzle. I mean, Leo's a great actor, and when you give a good actor a role like this that he can just kind of, like, dive into it, kind of wallow in it, and just, like, kind of stretch out, I like using the phrase knocks it out the park. That basically tells you who my favorite would be if I had to cast the vote. I love Leo in this film, and I think he was probably the best thing in it, believe it or not, for me.
No, I think he's the best thing in it as well. The movie doesn't really take off until he shows up. And I like Christoph Waltz in that film as well. I think he's not quite as good as he was in Glorious Bastards, but then the part isn't quite as juicy as that role was. DiCaprio gets the juicy role here. But the rest of these people in this category, you know, I don't really understand the Alan Arkin for Argo thing. I talked to a lot of people over the last 2 weeks who've really been talking a lot about his role in that film. It didn't blow me away. It seemed like just another, you know, Alan Arkin appearance to me.
You're absolutely
and,
right.
And it's not saying it was bad. It's just it didn't stand out, or it didn't even really separate itself from John Goodman in the movie. The two were locked at the hip as far as I was concerned.
Yeah, I agree they were locked at the hip, but I'd even put Goodman a little bit further. If you're going to nominate somebody from Argo, I think Goodman gets a nomination over Arkin. But, you know, Alan Arkin
I was
Tommy
surprised
Lee Jones,
Christopher Walken wasn't in there. I thought Christopher Walken would have taken the spot.
Seven Psychopaths?
For Seven Psychopaths, or, I mean, I know a lot of people didn't get to see the late Quartet or Stand Up Guys. I thought he was good in all three of those.
Mm-hmm.
For best supporting, if you wanted to do that, but at least for Seven Psychopaths, I thought he was far superior to Alan Arkin in Argo.
Go ahead, Tim.
No, I was going to say, I would say that the strength of Arkin's nomination is largely rooted in the success and the feelings that people have for Argo, and if you look at that film as a whole, it was a great ensemble, but. When you say Goodman stands out, I think Goodman and Arkin are joined at the hip. But the difference is that Arkin has already won a supporting actor Oscar for Little Miss Sunshine, and he delivers a little of that magic in this film in a way that people remember because people saw Goodman in Flight, you know, so those two kind of roles kind of balance each other out. So Argo is the much better film, I'm not going to use much better. Argo is the more popular film, more popular than Beasts of the Southern Wild, which is why Dwight Henry got looked over, more popular than The Seven Psychopaths, which is why Walken got looked over. So it's understanding the mindset of the voters of our branch, and, you know, we sit at the movies with them, you know, on average 3 to 4 nights a week over a year, you know, a week for a year,
yeah.
You know, over 12
Think of those
months.
People. Think of those
right,
people.
So I mean, you understand what buttons these films are pushing for the voters of our association.
Yeah, and you know, I might get killed for this, but you know, even Tommy Lee Jones, I didn't think he brought much to the role other than just being Tommy Lee Jones. He didn't transform it. He didn't bring a whole lot to it. It was just Tommy Lee Jones acting. You know, especially when you have Dwight Henry who needs a nomination. Mm-hmm. You have I just lost it. Russell Crowe in Les Mis. I thought he was amazing, especially considering that Les Miserables was the first time a musical, the performances were done on set there and not dubbed over. I mean, that even adds to it even more of what was done in that role. And supporting actor really kind of threw me for a loop here because Alan Arkin, I agree with you guys on that. Tommy Lee Jones, I don't know. And even Javier Bardem, I think there are some other performances that could take him out of that as well. You know, I just didn't see a lot of that coming. Even Robert De Niro in Silver Linings Playbook. I mean, I think he should have had one as well.
Yeah.
I would agree. I think John makes a good point. But like I said, man, I think that it's a combination. And Travis, we've talked about this before. It's a combination of what people see last.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a combination of certain movies, what images stick out. And in Argo, I'm telling you, think about Argo right now as you remember it the last time we saw it, if you haven't watched the screener,
yeah.
That you, Affleck, you know, you give him, you know, credit as a director. As an actor, he didn't really do anything that stood out. Goodman and what's his name from Breaking Bad? Who's in
Bryan Cranston.
Bryan Cranston.
I mean, they were all good, but... You know, I do remember him saying "Argo, F yourself" a bunch of times and having a lot of fun with that. And I think that line and that
ensemble.
Imagery stuck in people's minds, man.
It's such an ensemble that I didn't feel like a lot of those characters had a lot to do. And it's just that after a certain point, those characters tend to disappear a little bit. And that's why I try to look at supporting performances that are a little bit more complete, where they play such a critical role in the film that. You know, the movie would have been lesser without them. I don't know if that's the case with these characters in Argo. So that's right. My thing. I would have preferred to have seen Michael Pena in this category for
yeah.
the watch. Over
Let me ask a question because I don't have the nominations in front of me.
Yeah.
Did Michael Caine get a nomination from us for The Dark Knight Rises?
No.
Dark Knight didn't get one nomination.
It didn't get anything.
That to me is a crime because I thought that out of a movie that had to have a standout role, Michael Caine was easily to me the strongest thing that was in The Dark Knight Rises, and I voted for him in my preliminary ballot, and I was upset. And not seeing his name on it, and it just didn't cross my mind until we were just talking about this. So you talking about people who were left off? Caine easily could have gotten a nomination for that role in this film.
He could have gotten it for that one scene. Like, there's really one scene for him in that movie because he's another one that his character disappears for a long time in that movie, but he has one really fantastic scene in there that I think could have got him the nomination all by itself.
I would say he had three, because in that movie, he's the only one that brings any emotional attachment that we can connect to. Like, everybody else is just so messed up in the head, they don't care what's going on. He's the only kind of normal person with normal emotions that really shows everything. And he's got the scene at the end, which I won't spoil, not the one, you know which one I'm talking about, the emotional one. And then when he confronts Bruce about what he's doing, there's... I'm kind of upset with myself that I didn't think about it for Best Supporting Actor. I will say I didn't, but he definitely could have taken one of those spots.
Yeah. Moving on to Best Actor. This is another one that I think is interesting, although I'm pretty sure we know who's going to win this. The nominees for this one are Daniel Day-Lewis for Lincoln, John Hawks for The Sessions, Hugh Jackman for Les Miserables, Joaquin Phoenix for The Master, and Denzel Washington for Flight. This one seems like a no-brainer for Daniel Day-Lewis, but does anybody think there's any chance somebody else could sneak in here and take it? What do you think, John?
Probably not, unfortunately, because Daniel Day-Lewis just seems like the kind of person that if he's at the Oscars, or I'm sorry, we're talking about WAFTA Awards, in any awards, if he's at those, people are going to say, oh, it's Daniel Day-Lewis. To be honest with you, I think he did a great job with Lincoln, but I think a lot of it was in the makeup. His voice and his movements were great, but I don't think that it was a top-level performance that people are giving it. I think John Hawks was better in The Sessions. I know you brought up Hugh Jackman, but I thought he was pretty amazing in Les Miserables. And, I would even give a nomination to Bradley Cooper in Silver Linings Playbook. What he showed in that, I think, was more worthy of a nomination than Day-Lewis even getting the nomination, more or less the award. But I think you're right. I think he will take it. Certainly he and Denzel, I don't think, should have gotten the nomination for Flight. And Joaquin Phoenix is even kind of on the edge for me.
Tim?
John is crazy. I don't know what John's talking about. Wait, hold on a second. Let me move out of the congested streets of D.C. Daniel Day-Lewis. No, but for some odd reason, the president is coming through the city, so hold on one second. Hold on. Right, put me on mute or something.
I'm going to mute you for a second.
For 10 seconds. Go ahead.
Yeah, Tim has
That's
been
right. Technically,
for a few seconds.
President Obama is now on Punch Drunk Critics Live in some form.
All right. Well, for me, I would like to see Joaquin Phoenix take this one. I think he's better than Daniel Day-Lewis was in Lincoln, and that's not a knock against Daniel Day-Lewis, who I think is the best actor working today. But I felt that Joaquin Phoenix so embodied that particular character, a character that we have not seen before, that he really just drives the master all the way through. Whereas Lincoln, as great as Daniel Day-Lewis is, it also is an ensemble, and his character is not the focal point necessarily of that film. Mm-hmm. The real focal point of that movie is the process and all the people around him. I think he does do a great job as Lincoln. I think he gets the president's charisma, his ability to always know the right thing to say at the right time. I think he gets that. But I thought Joaquin Phoenix was just amazing in The Master, so I would like to see him win it. This is an interesting category. I would not have put Hugh Jackman in there for Les Miserables at all. I just don't think much of that movie, to be honest. So I'm not going to give anybody any credit except for one particular person, and it's not him. But I don't know. I would have preferred to have seen some other people in that role, maybe Clark Peters from Red Hook Summer. Or Brad Pitt for Killing Them Softly, but let's get Tim back in here. I assume the president has made it back home by now.
And it literally was the president for real. You thought I was playing. That really was him. But anyway, I just heard what you said, and I'm going to go back to John. John is crazy. First of all, you can say it's makeup. You can say whatever you want to. Travis has said it's an ensemble, and it's really not about him. The facts are these. Daniel Day-Lewis has won 2 Oscars. Daniel Day-Lewis is a method actor. Daniel Day-Lewis embodied this character in a way and gave us a version of Lincoln that we've never seen on screen before, from his voice, his inflection, his look, his performance. There are about 2 scenes in there that they're going to play over and over on Oscar night and Golden Globe night. He is far and away the most, like there's another category we're going to talk about in a minute where I think that person is a lot to win. He is as a lot to win and as money as it's going to be this Oscar season. He's the man. I mean, it's an amazing performance by him. And to try to minimize it and say, he's a part of the ensemble. It's not real. The facts are these. As a Steven Spielberg film, this is the good Spielberg. Daniel Day-Lewis, who is always solid, is great again. He is the focal point. It's a character that I'm not going to say a character. He's a president that is like a heroic figure in American politics, and for him to pull this off, and it is an ensemble because it's about his performance, Spielberg's direction, Tony Kushner's script, and all of the other supporting talent around him. He is magic and money and Lincoln.
Now, let me say something here. This is the most enthusiastic I've ever heard you be about Lincoln. I mean, I know we're talking about Daniel Day-Lewis.
No. This is not the most enthusiastic. No. Not about Lincoln. About this guy, this one character. I'm not enthusiastic about the film.
No. But you're talking about the film more so than you're talking about Daniel Day-Lewis here. You're talking about Spielberg and his direction and all that stuff. That's not Daniel Day-Lewis. We're talking about Daniel Day-Lewis here. Daniel Day-Lewis let me finish. Daniel Day-Lewis's performance is the best part of Steven Spielberg's Lincoln, by far. The rest of the movie itself, I think, has many problems. Daniel Day-Lewis is not one of them. I think he's fantastic in the role as well. I think he does exactly all the things you said and the things I said earlier. But in terms of Lincoln, I think Lincoln is still a very flawed film, and maybe that's one of the reasons why I look at Joaquin Phoenix as a better choice for Best Actor to me, because The Master to me is a better film overall than Lincoln is. And I think a part of the reason why it's so good is because Joaquin Phoenix is so good. Whereas Daniel Day-Lewis, as great as he was, couldn't make Lincoln a better film. So that's why I
okay.
And Tim,
okay.
Real quick, just to defend me, I'm not saying Daniel Day-Lewis wasn't great, but 2 of the points you made when you were addressing what I said are exactly what I'm talking about. The first 2 things you said were Daniel Day-Lewis has won 2 Oscars, Daniel Day-Lewis is a method actor. I think those 2 things are influencing how people perceive his performance in this, or at least how they perceive his performance against everything else, because they know he's always good, so he must be awesome in this. I think he was great in the role, but I just think people are giving a lot more credit than maybe he deserves. I don't think it's the best of his career, and I don't think he should be a shoo-in just because he's Daniel Day-Lewis.
All right, guys, here we go again. Real talk. All right, this is the 3 of us, right? All right. The people who vote in critic associations. Now, Travis, who does my show every week, you know you're talking to Omar Moore, who's in San Francisco. You're talking to Wilson, who's with BFCC. So my point is that the group of people who are voting on these awards are people just like us, right? And people just like us are influenced by past performance, by past awards, by the hype that's put into films. So my point is for you telling me, and again, I'm not disagreeing with either of you guys. I agree with you, and Travis is absolutely right. I'm not enthusiastic about the film, but Travis, you hit the nail on the head when you said that Daniel Day-Lewis is the best thing about this film, and even though the film is not a super film, I don't think it's the equal of another film that received nominations from us, but I think that the performance by Daniel Day-Lewis stands head and shoulders above all the other performances that I've seen in this category. Now, I wish there were some other people that were in this category. You talked about Clark Peters. I thought about Brad Pitt and Killing Them Softly.
Yep.
I thought about several other actors that I thought could have easily been in this category. But if you had put them in the category, I still think that Lewis would have been better than them.
I agree.
So all of those things that you talk about, you know, hey, wow, you know, these guys, you know, people are buying into the hype, or, you know, oh, he's not really that good. To be perfectly honest, and you've heard me say this, I thought Denzel Washington was okay in Flight. Everybody
right.
else seems to think that Denzel is magic in this movie, and I'm like,
yeah.
I've watched it a couple of times. I'm like, well, I don't see it, but if y'all believe that, I'll ride along on the wave.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
And it's all personal preference. You talk about Les Miserables. I like that film more than you do. I'm not necessarily positive that I like Hugh Jackman as much because I really love the Les Miserables stage play more than I like the movie. But that's another story. That's splitting hairs. But all of this comes with our own personal opinions and our own prejudices and what we're bringing to each film experience on how we're voting for these awards.
All right. So let's jump into Best Supporting Actress, since you just mentioned Les Miserables. I think this category is about as much of a lock as a movie can, as a category can be. I think you said that earlier, Tim. And I'm pretty sure this is the category you were referring to. We got Amy
Yes.
We got Amy Adams for The Master, Samantha Barks for Les Miserables, Sally Field for Lincoln, Anne Hathaway for Les Miserables, and Helen Hunt for The Sessions. I think we knew 3 months ago that Anne Hathaway was going to win for Les Miserables for what is essentially one scene. She doesn't really have a whole lot else to do in this movie other than a couple of scenes there. But her performance of I Dreamed a Dream, of course, is the one that everybody's going to remember about this movie. I think it's a lock. Anybody see any chance of anybody else sneaking in here?
No, I mean I think that's a lot. I mean, there's a small chance I'd say that just on the back of Lincoln, Sally Field might pull it out. But even Samantha Barks, I think, might have been a little bit better than Anne Hathaway if you really lay them next to each other. But it happens. I mean, you know, I'm just saying, if you put them right next to each other, I think Samantha Barks put a more consistent, better performance down. Anne Hathaway did knock the one song out of the park, though, and you know she's got the close up with the high pitched long song, so she's going to get it without that. Is there anybody that wasn't? This is the one category that I really didn't have a lot of things that I wanted to nominate. There wasn't anybody left out. Is there anything that maybe should have been on here that you guys didn't see?
I would have championed it, and I understand nobody saw the movie, but Lorraine Toussaint in Middle of Nowhere, I voted for her, and I knew it was just kind of like my protest vote because nobody else saw the film. but it bothers me, and I think that's another part of something that's not just a WAFTA issue, but that's an issue around the country as I talk to other film critic presidents, that, you know, their films, little small films, that don't get the distribution of a Lincoln, of an Argo, of a Les Miserables, of a Skyfall, that suffer because, I hate to say it like this, but it's true, in order to be a player during award season, you got to spend money. You got to get out on the trail. You got to promote films. You got to send screeners out. You got to woo the critics in order to try to get some votes. And unfortunately, I'm not saying the director of that film's name on this show, but Wilson Morales and I have talked. I talked to Dow Lockhart, you know, who all are in different critics associations, that we didn't feel that they made an effort to get the film in front of enough eyes in order to get the performances, you know, acknowledged. So I'm like, hey.
Unfortunately, that's true. It's true. It's not often that a fantastic performance can stand out on its own. I mean, it's just not that often that it happens. But, you know, there were a couple of actresses that I thought should have been in this category. Whether they would have won or not is a different story. I would have liked to have seen Emma Watson for The Perks of Being a Wallflower. I would have liked to have seen her in this category. And I would have liked to have seen Pauline Collins, who was fantastic in Quartet, which nobody saw. I would have liked to have seen her in this movie because she was really the heart and soul of that kind of musically themed film. But other than that, this category is about a shoe-in. So let's just go ahead and move on to the Best Director category. Where we've got Ben Affleck for Argo, Paul Thomas Anderson for The Master, Catherine Bigelow for Zero Dark Thirty, Tom Hooper for Les Miserables, and Steven Spielberg for Lincoln.
How mad
this
were
one,
you,
this
Tim?
This is interesting. This is an interesting one.
Well, can I go first on this one?
Please do.
Sure.
This category, to me, it, along with Best Picture, are going to be the highlights of Oscar night.
Mm-hmm.
The drama, already before we get there, Steven Spielberg, two Oscar wins already. Saving Private Ryan, Schindler's List.
Mm-hmm.
Catherine Bigelow, Best Director for The Hurt Locker. You're looking at a scenario this year, and again, there's a lot of time between now and Oscar night, but I think you're going to have to go back a lot of years to see a highly publicized head-to-head battle like the one you're going to see between these two, and trust me, one of these two are going to win this Oscar. There is no – I'm just being honest. I mean, Steven Spielberg has made a bunch of films that are, you know, that have been disappointments recently. You know, you heard me talk about Horror Horse. You heard me talk about Munich and some other films that just didn't click with audiences. This is the good Spielberg. Lincoln is a film that is a comeback for Spielberg. People like the film. It's getting good buzz. But Zero Dark Thirty is also a movie that has won two Critics Association Awards and is starting to build for it as well. I am really, really excited about how this is going to come out, and I have an instinct, my gut is telling me what I think it is right now, but a lot can change between now and then.
Well, look, I'm not so sure this is quite the lock you think it is. As much as I agree with you that Spielberg and Zero Dark Thirty are probably the top two, you know what my pick out of these five is. It's The Master, I think. Although I slaved with myself over whether to choose Zero Dark Thirty or The Master. I think they're both amazing films and probably my top two of the year. I think there is such a critical buzz for Les Miserables that I will not be surprised to see that film sneak in a victory. I will not be surprised. I haven't heard reviews for a movie all year like the ones I heard for Les Miserables. I mean, it was just ridiculous. Now, of course, some of that has been muted as more people have seen it over the last couple weeks, but I have to believe that initial excitement still exists for a lot of people, because the people who saw that movie early on were the people who are going to be doing a lot of this voting. So I will not be surprised if Les Miserables sneaks in a victory. I do suspect that Zero Dark Thirty is going to take this one, just because it seems to have so much momentum right now. But this is a really tough category. And I kind of feel bad for Ben Affleck. He's going to be that guy who's going to be an also-ran for a long time. And he's going to end up getting an award for something later on, for something that probably shouldn't win. I get that feeling about him.
Yeah.
But, John, what do you think?
You know, director's always something I have a hard time with, because I really try to look at what the director adds to the picture. I mean, I think a lot of times we mix up, not we being people on the phone, I mean, anybody watching a movie thinks the good film is because of a good director. Well, it usually is, but it's also because of a lot of other stuff, too. You know, like Tom Hooper for Les Mis, it's almost a direct-by-numbers thing at this point, isn't it? I mean, I know stage directing and film directing is two totally different things, but you know what kind of shots you have to get. You know how certain things have to go. And you know, certainly The Master and Zero Dark Thirty are going to be tops. Lincoln's obviously going to have a lot, but I'd almost like to even see something that's really a huge achievement in directing. Like, this is going to sound crazy,
like Cloud Atlas?
No, like Chris Butler and Sam Fell for Paranorman. I mean, you're doing stop-motion animation where it's all the director. It's not the performances. It's not this. It's all what the director sees happening with the stop-motion. And that movie looks so good. It's so amazing. I would have liked to at least see a nomination. And I know everybody's going to think I'm crazy for saying that, but as far as directing,
really,
I think that's the hardest job and the best job that was done.
Well, you hear me say all the time that I hate directors that don't put a fingerprint on their movies.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is one time where all five of these directors put a fingerprint on their movies. Spielberg's Lincoln is very much a Spielberg film. By the time you watch it, if you didn't know that it was a Spielberg film, you knew by the end of it that it was. Tom Hooper, Les Miserables is shot almost exactly the same way as The King's Speech is. He uses wide lenses. He uses a very specific sort of framing device for all of his movies. I can tell a Tom Hooper's film a mile away, Les Miserables is one. Catherine Bigelow's Zero Dark Thirty is the same way. And Paul Thomas Anderson's The Master feels like all of his other films. And the same thing goes for Ben Affleck in Argo. So I appreciate this category a bit more this year than I do some other years, because I do feel like all five of these directors really added something to the film. Whether or not I like the end result is a different story, but I do appreciate that they all put something into it that I can see.
Right.
So I like that.
Not to put you on the spot, but I mean, because Catherine Bigelow is so new, what would you say her fingerprint is? Like, everybody knows a Spielberg movie. Paul Thomas Anderson know at this point, but Catherine really just Hurt Locker.
I think she puts a really tight focus on her character. She uses a lot of up close framing for her characters. Right. She did that in The Hurt Locker. She does it here with Jessica Chastain very often. And I think she brings a very claustrophobic style to a lot of her movies. She does it here as well. This one almost felt a little bit to me like a David Fincher film in the way she shoots it, which I think is interesting to see applied to a global crime procedural. It's interesting to see her doing that, and I like the result.
Okay, I can feel you on that. Yeah, I'm with you. I wanted to see what I thought was actually what was going on.
All right, gentlemen. Well, you see, y'all cut Shed a Brother out. Let me just jump in last word on this category. I think the big issue that Les Miserables is going to be up against, and again, hear me on this one really closely, is that you got a certain segment of voter or movie audience who absolutely abhors musicals. And when I'm talking about musicals, I'm talking about musicals like Les Miserables, where it's sung straight through. So, I've been talking to people recently about the film, telling them you need to check it out. And you can only imagine how many people tell me, man, I can't get with that. That's almost like watching a horror film for some people. And number two, the biggest issue I think this film is going to be up against is that the iconic stage plays, which people have bought and have seen this film over the course of seen this play over the course of 27 years. I personally think that although the songbook matches the film songbook matches the songbook for the play, I still think that the play to me is more powerful, and I think that some people will feel that way, even though it has been hyped endlessly. And I read that ridiculous review on Huffington Post about it being the best film ever. I was like, dude, really? Come on, man. No, not even remotely close. But it is powerful, and I think it's a good story. But I think that fact alone, that a lot of people are going to not see this film, is going to hurt it in the end.
Yeah, and you know what? Just to shed light on what, that's actually the same thing I said to my wife when we were watching it, about the stage performance being better, because there's one thing that this movie is missing that really gives the stage performance a lot more, and that's I don't know really how to say it, but feeling the voices of the people singing. I mean, there's a difference between listening to it on TV and being there when they're singing, and the power that's coming from that ensemble chorus that's coming at you when they're singing to it, and that's something that is missing. That being said, with that out of it, I think they still did an amazing job. I don't think he'll get Best Director. I think, you guys are right on the money with Bigelow or Spielberg.
I think Tom Hooper's decision to film the vocal portions the way he does was a double-edged sword. Without going too deep into it, I think it worked better for some people and didn't work so well for others, which hurts yourself. All right.
It didn't work well for Maximus, man. Maximus didn't give me love. I'm sorry, man. My fault. Go ahead, man.
Nah, it's cool, man. It's not just him. There are a couple others that didn't always work out so well for. All right, the last category we're going to talk about here, we've talked about all the major acting categories. The last category is Best Film. This is the big daddy. And the five we've got for this one are Argo, Les Miserables, Lincoln, Silver Linings Playbook, Zero Dark Thirty. Obviously, I'm disappointed to not see Rust and Bone here, but it is... It's up there for best foreign film, so I'll just take that for what it's worth. And I'm also upset to not see The Master here. But dealing with the five that we have, what are we going to say that the big two are here? Are we looking at Lincoln and Zero Dark Thirty, and nothing else really stands a chance?
Well, you're looking at the same. I apologize for jumping in. You're looking at the same two films that we just talked about. I think Les Mis has an outside shot. I think the other important factor in looking at these five films is that if my calculations are correct, three of them are either films that directly are about our government. Would that be yeah, I would say that would be actually honest. In Argo, Zero Dark Thirty, and Lincoln. So you're dealing with a highly politicized field of nominees, and I got the feeling that Argo is going to get a Best Picture nomination. So I think that theme will be running throughout the show all year long, where you'll have Les Mis trying to sneak in there. But I think for the most part, man, I mean, the same exact conversation we just had for Best Director will be the conversation we will have for Best Picture.
Yeah, right. I mean, what you're saying could actually be applied to Les Mis if you think about it, because it's just another thing of you know, people going against the government that's holding them down type deal.
Yeah,
and that's an obvious theme. I didn't even think about it until Travis just said something. But I am really surprised to not see The Master in this list. I am very glad to see Silver Linings Playbook. I'm still surprised it got to take over The Master, though, because I got to imagine that was the next one down the line to get on there as The Master. So Playbook had to have taken that spot. I don't think there's much outside of Lincoln or Zero Dark Thirty that's really going to pull this. Les Mis is going to have some buzz, but I think, like Travis said, you know, once more reviews come out, once time goes by, because, you know, the other thing going for is Zero Dark Thirty still hasn't had its major screening release or you know, even audience release, so that's going to have the most buzz going into voting time.
Yeah, Zero Dark Thirty has, it's on a roll right now. It's got, Tim mentioned two awards it's already taken. I think it actually just took a third. Most recently, I think it's got the Boston Online Film Critics National Board of Review, and I believe it just won Best Picture for the New York Film Critics Circle also. So Zero Dark Thirty is just, it's riding a serious wave of momentum. Out of this five, I think it's probably got the best shot because of that, and also because it's just a fantastically made, well-made film. it really is. I think those are the major categories. We don't really need to go into all the other ones. But is there anything, Tim, that you were really shocked by out of all these categories? Something you didn't see get in there for any particular category that surprised you?
Well, I'm going to be very, very transparent in that, you know, you and I have both shared. I haven't listened to John long enough to really find out which movies, or we haven't had a conversation about which movies, that John really didn't care for that are some of the more popular films. I made no secret of the fact that I'm not a huge Flight fan. I made no bones that I thought Moonrise Kingdom was a good film, but I thought it has a particular audience that it serves, and I don't think it's a wide audience. So I was really surprised to see it get so many nominations. I was like, wow, really? I mean, I was also surprised that Matthew McConaughey, who I thought delivered he was in three films this year. I thought he was exceptional in two of them. I mean, nobody saw Killer Joe. People saw Magic Mike, and there were other performances that came in late, namely Leo DiCaprio, that overshadowed him. But I was really surprised that there was not more love for him. And then the third biggest surprise, again, it's Beasts of the Southern Wild. I'm really surprised that, you know, and I understand that we have some exceptional films and performances that are up, but Corbinjane Wallace, the girl was 6 years old when they asked her, to headline a film and carry it on her back, never acted before, you know, basically in elementary school, and she makes one of the most best reviewed films of 2012, and is literally like invisible right now. That surprises me, because I still think she has an outside shot to get an Oscar nomination, because Fox Searchlight is not going to let folks forget that Beasts of the Southern Wild came out and got all those great reviews.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right, and I agree with you wholeheartedly about Moonrise Kingdom. I thought it was good, but it's for a very I didn't think it was very good. It's for a very select few. I thought it was a little bit too quirky. I don't think the performances were very good. And everybody seems to be phoning it in. But the biggest category that killed me here was best score. Because, Tim, I know that you're upset. And so I haven't heard you say anything about Dark Knight Rises except for supporting actor. You know, that could have been up for film, director. There's a lot of stuff better than it, but I'm just saying could have been nominated. But the thing I wanted it nominated for the most was its score. I mean, that chanting score when Bruce Wayne is trying to get out of the prison and everything that goes throughout the whole movie was a character in that movie, I thought. I mean, it really elevated. And Moonrise Kingdom doesn't have a single song that doesn't sound like it was playing at a coffee shop that I would remember. You know, I thought you know, for that to be out of everything, for no Dark Knight Rises stuff, I mean, I don't think it should get stuff just because it was a popular movie. But there's a lot of things that could have got here, most notably score and nothing.
I think this is a really exceptional year for a movie soundtracks, and I agree with you that the Dark Knight Rises score is very good. I don't know if I would have put it ahead of any of the nominees that we have. I wouldn't have put it ahead of The Hobbit. I wouldn't have put it against over Beast of Southern Wild score. I wouldn't have put it over Moonrise Kingdom score, which I think has a very fairy tale element to it, and really is one of the things that makes that movie work. I disagree with you guys in that it's just, you know, especially the thing with people phoning it in. I certainly don't agree with that. I think the two young stars of that film are what make it as good as it was. And we can argue about Bruce Willis and those guys, but everybody else, I think, is fantastic. And The Master, I mean, Johnny Greenwood's soundtrack is, you know, the metronomic score he provides to that film is exceptional. So I disagree with all that stuff, but you know, this is why it's opinions and whatever.
Yes, indeed.
Yep. But for me, I think I've pretty much made all my the things that got left out for me clear. Rust and Bone, Pena, Dwight Henry. I think these are some of the big things that have been left out for me that I thought were a little shocking. Mm-hmm. And I was a little bit surprised that Django Unchained didn't perform better. Like, I figured since we just saw it, it would be fresh in people's minds, and that it would get a couple more nominations for something. But maybe it's because it was fresh in people's minds that it didn't. So
right? No. Maybe it didn't get a bunch of nominations because maybe it didn't deserve a bunch of nominations.
That's possible. I mean, it's possible. But I did think it deserves more than what it got. So, but you know.
All right, so I'm ready to jump off the phone, but the thing want the audience to know is Travis Hobson will be joining me at approximately 8 o'clock, about 12 hours from now.
Yep.
And we're going to announce the winners of these awards live on air. John, starting at 8:15, I've already read the email, you guys. I mean, not you, but John, you're welcome to call in, give reaction. Mm-hmm. I'm really looking forward to our 11th annual WAFCA Awards announcement show. This is Travis. This will be your second year co-hosting this thing with me.
Second year co-hosting.
Yeah, man. So I'm excited, man. There's some, you know, 11 is a really good year, man. So all of these categories and these nominees that we talked about in these major awards, will WAFCA add to what the other voices are saying? Or will we do what we typically do, which is go our own way, thumb our nose at the system and say, screw you, we're D.C.?
I think that's the way to go, because I think that we should be the Oscars, honestly. We are the best and the brightest of this country when it comes to talking about movies. So you guys can check that out tomorrow morning, 8 o'clock, blogtalkradio.com/filmgordon. Make sure to get there bright and early, because these are the most important awards of the year. Let's not pull strings here. It really is.
All right, gentlemen.
All right, Tim, man. Thanks for calling in, man. I will see you in the morning.
All right, man. You guys take care, man.
All right, later.
Bye.
Before we wrap up, I just wanted to ask you, animated feature. I thought this was going to be between two movies, but at this point, it's really between three, I think. Frankenweenie, Paranorman, and Rise of the Guardians.
Mm.
What would your choice be for best animated?
I really had to beat myself up over this one for a while. This one had me stumped. Last night, trying to figure out which one I wanted to vote for. Do I want to vote for, and this is going to surprise you, that Wreck-It Ralph was not in my top three, as much as I enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. It was between Rise of the Guardians, Paranorman, and Frankenweenie. And ultimately, I think I would prefer to see Rise of the Guardians take this one. I did really enjoy that film. It was different than everything else. And, you know, Frankenweenie and Paranorman were also very unique films, although not unique amongst each other. unique overall. We haven't seen a lot of movies like them over the last few years. But Rise of the Guardians was something that I hadn't seen before, which is a more action-oriented holiday film, which I thought was a nice, refreshing way to take things. Because I'm not usually a big fan of holiday movies. They tend to bore the crap out of me. I haven't liked them since I was a child. But I was totally invested in this one. It has fantastic animation, great voice work, and some of the most beautiful animated scenes I saw all year, especially when it came to the Sandman. I thought some of the things his character did were just gorgeous. So, yeah. I mean, I was totally into Rise of the Guardians.
I mean, people can say that the publicity studios doesn't really do much to change people's mind, but honestly, for me, it was between Frankenweenie and Paranorman until last week. I mean, I was blown away by Rise of the Guardians, don't get me wrong, but last week we get into the mail this this art book of Rise of the Guardians, yeah. And I started flipping through it. I had to put the movie on again because I was like, this is gorgeous. I mean, this is amazing looking, and, you know, what they do with the Tooth Fairy's world in this place, and it is so different than everything else. And, you know, Frankenweenie and Paranorman, I think, are going to have trouble because, like you said, they're not very different from each other, so you can't really remember which one. You know, I almost had to watch them again to really get out my feelings on each one separated. But, you know, I'd like to see Rise of the Guardians win as well. I think it has a good chance as far as I would imagine. And the only other thing that really bugged me was the ensemble category. We won't really go into it, but, you know, I thought there was a lot of stuff that could have been – I mean, again, you know, there's so many good movies that fit all these roles. I mean, a lot of the stuff that I'd like to see in there is really outside chance stuff. But even something like Seven Psychopaths, I thought that was
– Yeah. You know, ensemble's a tough category. In fact, I've never really been a big fan of the acting ensemble category, whether it's here or in the Golden Globes or wherever else. I don't like it because, to me, it sounds like Best Picture.
Because
that's what it sounds like to me. The best movie of the year generally has the best cast and the best performances. The best overall performances anyway. So I've never really dug that category because it's also very subjective. You know, it's just one of those things. There are 50 films I could put into a best acting ensemble category. Shit, I could put The Expendables in best ensemble.
I actually did not want to. My joke.
You know? It's just not a category that makes a whole lot of sense to me. I've never really liked it.
Yeah, I've always just looked at it as, because, I mean, like you said, any movie that's good will have a good ensemble because everybody will be good. I always look at it as, and maybe this is wrong of me, but I look at it as places where there's no complete standout performance, but everybody together is good.
If that's the case, then Lincoln shouldn't be in there. Zero Dark Thirty shouldn't be in there. Argo probably shouldn't be in there. I mean, there's a lot of these things. You know, it's like, that's why I don't like the acting ensemble. It's just too subjective. All right, I think that's pretty much it. We've only got a couple minutes left here. Next week's show.
Mm-hmm.
Next week's show, we have our interview with Roger Mitchell.
Yes.
The director of Hyde Park on Hudson. We'll be talking about that film. And we'll also be talking about a little film you might have heard of called The Hobbit: An Unexpected Journey. I don't know if you've heard of it or not. It's just a little film that's coming out on video on demand. So we'll talk
about
that.
It's not Land of the Hobbits. It's not the big movie that we talked about earlier.
It's not Age of the Hobbits. It's not that.
The guy from Stargate is not in this movie.
We'll be talking about those next week. And I feel like I should say now, it feels like this is the right time for me to say it, the December 30th show will be my final show. My final show here. I'm moving on to do my own show starting in January called Cinema Royale, which, John, you will be a part of often because you're my homie and I couldn't do it without you. So you're going to be there with me, along with everybody else, I should say. My goal is to have a different DC film critic on every week. So, but we're not going away completely. We're still going to be doing stuff here. Punch Drunk Critics still remains. Nothing else changes. It just won't be Punch Drunk Critics Live every single week. But we'll do it every recovery. We'll still do it every once in a while.
Yeah. Because come summertime, we'll have your pre-shows for you to get you sped up on all the geek culture stuff that you need to know. But we're just, you know, taking different paths. We're spreading out our expertise in the world, as it were.
Exactly. So we're not going away completely. We'll just be in different places and still together. So, you know, ain't that much changing.
Word. Other than the awesome name, I really got to give you more props for that. That's an awesome name. I was thinking about that after I talked to you. I was like, man, that's pretty silly. I like that. But yeah, next week is The Hobbit. And then on our last show of Punch Drunk Critics Live, we'll probably bring you our best of 2012 or our
–
you know, we'll think of something special for you guys to check out on that. But with 60 seconds left, check us out every day at punchdrunkcritics.com. Facebook, search for Punch Drunk Critics. Twitter, at Punchy Critic is Travis. Questions, comments, punchdrunkcritics@gmail.com or yahoo.com. We are out of here, guys.
Later.
Check us out every day and next week this time. Bye.
We came, we saw, we kicked its ass.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
I'm not great at farewell, so that'll do, pig.
That's the worst goodbye I've ever heard. And you stole it from a movie.